The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this opening ceremony for the for International Week at the Law School. This is a new and exciting opportunity at the Law School. This is the first time we've had an International Week. The purpose of the week is to stimulate interest and discussion and thought about international law and international affairs in the law school community, and also to create opportunities for the students, particularly new students, to learn about all the different international activities at the law school, and about and to develop connections and to learn for JD students to meet and get to know some of the international LLM students, and for international LLM students to meet some of the JD students, particularly first-year JD students who they might not meet in classrooms. We thought that to open this event, we would have a panel that would allow you to meet some of the faculty at the law school who work in the international area and who will talk a bit about their work as international lawyers, and give you some ideas to think about, some issues they're working on, some topics you can think about writing papers when you have to write upper level paper requirements, or for journals, or for issues for just general discussion. I should say two things to begin though. One is the international law faculty at this law school is so big that we couldn't get everyone onto the panel today. This is only a portion of the international law faculty. The rest of the international law faculty are participating in various events during the week, so that we hope over the course of the week you get to meet all of the international faculty. That's number one. Number two is, as you know, international law is a very important part of this law school and its activities. And so we thought that to open up International Week and to officially kick off the week, it would be important and appropriate to invite Dean Grossman to come and do that, both in his role as the dean and as part of the international law faculty. So it's my great pleasure to invite Dean Grossman to welcome you and to open this week.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Professor Bradlaugh, for your introduction and for your outstanding leadership of the International Legal Studies Program and your many contributions to the field of international law. Before we begin, I would like to thank the many officers of the law school who have worked so hard to develop and bring us engaging programs for this week-long initiative. As you can see from the program, a large number of offices and departments throughout the law school are participating in International Week, which is a testament to our community's wide-ranging commitment to this area of the law. It also shows the commitment of the institution to open up opportunities to share experiences not only in the framework of the relationship between students and faculty, but to see through extracurricular activities that you get all the knowledge and information required to decide as to your future career opportunities and possibilities. My colleagues who are here are very busy, and the fact that they put the time and effort, I mean, to share with you what have they done, and the way in which they see things, again, is a proof of what this institution is about and its commitment. I also would like to extend a special thanks to Kathy Schenker, the Associate Director of the International Legal Studies Program, for her leadership in organizing this extensive event. Kathy, thank you, and thank you in the ALSP group. Now, I have here the remarks, 4 or 5 pages, but I think it's better to detailing everything we do in international law in the institution. But I think that rather than doing that, it's much more exciting that we go to work right away and we share what you came here to hear and to listen, namely the experience that all of us have in terms of international law. You will discover by yourself the programs that we do in the law school here, and that's why I don't need to mention those, but I think that this panel and the too precious to engage in too many formalities. So again, welcome to you all, and let us start, Professor Bradlow. Thank you again for what you have done. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean Grossman. As I said, the purpose of this panel is really to help you, was to introduce to you all the members of the international law faculty on this panel, all of whom work as international lawyers, both as teachers, scholars, and as activists in various ways. And what I thought we'd do is ask each person to speak for about 5 minutes, talking about what they do as an international lawyer, what some of the issues that they're working on are, and as a way of not only stimulating you to think about international law, but also we hope to give you some ideas about things you could think about studying while you're here, some topics you could think about writing papers about, as well as career options that you might have in the future. I think what we'll do is we'll start, I don't know, maybe this isn't the best way of saying it, but the most senior person, and we'll go down the line and get everybody to comment just for 5 minutes. So, Dean Grossman, we'll start with you and then work our way just straight down the line.
It's a dubious honor to be senior, I would say. But it's an unavoidable situation. And I think I share that honor here but with Rick, but we cannot talk both of us at the same time because it would be confusing. Let me see. Following strictly the instructions by Professor Bradlow, I'm currently the Vice Chair of the Committee Against Torture of the United Nations. The last week, I had to review the... Nobody's taping this, right? Okay. In the Committee Against Torture, we do different things. One thing that we do is we review reports by states. That is the weakest form of supervision, probably. Supervision is measuring conduct against standards. That's a workable definition. You create also certain things. That's why you don't measure only. You also, because of the nature of language, you engage in creativity. But the weakest form of supervision is perhaps the reporting, because states present reports showing what they are doing in this case to apply their obligations in the Committee Against Torture, incorporating the definition against torture into the domestic realm, not sending people to countries where they have founded reasons to believe that they could be tortured, not accepting torture in judicial proceedings, training the police not only in torture but also in in the rejection of cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment and punish. All these type of things. So the last week, what I have done, the committee is meeting in November. I am the rapporteur on three countries actually. One is Ecuador, the other is Peru, and the third one is Latvia. So the committee received the report by a state saying, this is what we're doing to comply with the obligations of the Convention Against Torture of 1994. So our constitution prohibits torture, the police is well trained, great. You read it and you want to stand and applaud because it's great. Now, then we have developed something called list of issues. In other words, that we sent the country before the meeting in Geneva, some 25 questions, trying to bring some reality into this Pollyannish world that everything goes fine. So the key thing there is how to ask questions that bring the reality forward. And for example, on the prohibition against torture, we ask, do you have one single article in the penal code or many scattered provisions? Because it gives clarity to have one. Second thing, how many accusations of torture you have had, and how many have been handled, and how many have been sentenced by violating that. The training. Give us examples of your training. Is abstract, formalistic, or you work with cases? Do you involve the civil society in the training? And if you do so, which NGOs? The NGOs are a very powerful instrument. There are all type of NGOs, but I will tell you, in my view, God bless the NGOs because they project they give information, they enrich decision-making procedures, and they are the first line in thinking many, what's going on. In many countries, there is a crisis of representation through political parties. Well, so drafting that is important. So I've been working on that. Second thing, we're doing a general comment on Article 2 of the Convention Against Torture. Article 2 says that you cannot derogate from the prohibition against torture even under an emergency situation. So we have to think how to measure compliance with that better. What's the role of civil society, the role of the whole committee, and so forth and so on. And one thing in which I am specifically working is this. What is the role of the committee in Geneva when an independent judge in a country, Sweden, for example, has determined that there is no risk in sending someone to a different country? Can we reject a determination by a national authority? Under what conditions, and so forth and so on? When I was in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, we developed a theory of review called the fourth instance, which followed more or less a standard of review done by the Europeans called the theory of the margin of appreciation. That means that when you have due process in a domestic setting and the judges have acted well, we exercise a lot of we give them a lot of deference. In case of doubt, we agree with the domestic authorities because we're not interviewing the individuals. They have the benefit of being close to a situation. We retain jurisdiction to challenge a determination by a local judge that is not a problem to send somebody to a different country, for example, if that's the case. But we have the final word, but we will exercise caution and jurisdiction and respect for a judicial determination done on the basis of due process and with full participation of lawyers. I'm specifically in charge of presenting October the 6th a report on the standard of review of the Committee Against Torture. Now, I've mentioned you Ecuador, Peru, Latvia, and I have to prepare also because in the meeting in November, Latvia will be actually examined. So there are meetings with NGOs, meetings with government representatives, and I have to question them publicly and all this type of thing. I mean, they sent people sometimes at the level of cabinet representatives, and there is a tremendous responsibility. You finish with concluding observations, so you need to be well prepared. I have exceeded perhaps my 5 minutes. The last thing I want to say, we created in this law school the Impact Litigation Project. Agustin Alcampo is here, is the executive director of the Impact Litigation Project. And then we are presenting cases to the Inter-American system. And we have a couple of cases, one against Venezuela for a retired general called Uzon. We have a case concerning Brazil, a case concerning Mexico. And some of these cases might move ahead during the current sitting of the commission that starts next Monday. We don't have any hearing now, but we're meeting with Agustin, I think, tomorrow, to strategize on different things, perhaps doing lobby to some commissioners who are going to be here. I'm concerned about a couple of cases. I mean, you need to keep an eye. They have too many cases in the commission, so you need to lobby. We can talk about how you do that and to keep an eye on important things. We have also, there is also a case involving Jamaica that started before we created the impact litigation and relates to freedom of expression. A newspaper in Jamaica reproduced an article of news, the AP, the Associated Press, that said that one former minister of tourism was getting kickbacks from companies in the United States and that he was going to be indicted. Well, he was indicted, actually, but he negotiated his way out. A newspaper reproduced the cable of AP, and he was sentenced, the newspaper, to pay £1 million. You know, there were issues there, again, as to whether, the scope, content of the right of freedom of expression. Our opinion is when you reproduce something, when you I have 1 minute, it says. When you reproduce.
That's generous, that's because of the gene.
No, no, I hope not. That when you reproduce an act, something from associate presence or so on, you cannot be liable. I mean, also imagine there's not going to be a possibility for newspapers to publish anything. I appeared, I presented that case before the Inter-American Commission, and I said at that time, you know, imagine a newspaper would not have been able to reproduce anything about President Clinton, for example, unless the newspaper would have done investigation by itself. I mean, if you're reproducing a cable from an authoritative source and it says AP, they should not be liable. Also, the penalty was disproportionate and produced a chilling effect in freedom of expression in the Caribbean. Because then the newspapers immediately say, oh my God, we have to be extra careful. And we have an interest in a world where we have more corruption than what we can tolerate, you know, to promote a vigorous debate. Now, so I've mentioned to you some of the things that are keeping me busy. There are other type of things in terms of writing. I am the keynote speaker in an event done by University in Scotland. I'm talking about the future of the Inter-American system. There is a meeting Wednesday of all the international and regional courts of the world, the first one of its type, that is going to take place in Managua, Nicaragua, and I've been invited to be there. I have to prepare something. I mean, this happened like 3 days ago, so I've not yet adapted to the idea that I have to go there. To finalize, let me say something. Working in international law, at least in my area, which is human rights, is not a work from 9 to 5. It's not the result of a bureaucratic decision. But you can do that too. But people that work in this area have a commitment. Without getting messianic here and lights in the eye or whatever, I mean, you feel that when you're with your legal knowledge, you can make a difference and contribute to important values. And that creates, it's a very powerful motivation to do things. My experience also is when you work in that area of the law and you have that motivation, you get much more than what you give, because you are with a community of people who are motivated, they have good values, they are thinking in terms of promoting things that are very important. And I have been blessed by the fact that I've met a very important individual. So in no way this should be seen as how you're contributing so much. You get much more when you do these things than what you give. Thank you very much for your attention.
Good morning. My name is Rick Wilson. I'm the director of the International Human Rights Law Clinic. My roots in international law are not in law school. In law school, I think international law was about as far from a career as I imagined. And in the midst of law school, I decided to leave and join the Peace Corps in the 60s. And that was a life-changing moment for me. It redirected my view of the world. It taught me a new language. It put me in touch with a different set of cultural values, people of different class and ethnicity than my own. And I was stationed in Panama, and this was before the great conflicts of Central America in the 70s, and returned to law school to finish and begin work as a public defender. I only began thinking about international law when I began teaching law school at CUNY Law School in New York. And when I joined the faculty here with the encouragement of Dean Grossman and then Dean Elliot Milstein, I applied for and obtained federal funding for an international human rights law clinic. And that was really the beginning of my work in the field in 1990. And so I learned it from practice, not from theory. I learned it from working on cases and particular situations rather than studying it from a book in theory in a classroom. Since that time, I've pretty much shifted my writing and scholarship to international law and have focused most consistently, I think, on issues about clinical legal education and its adoption in countries in transition around the world. And later this month, I'll be in both Mexico and Moldova to do work with the Open Society folks who are promoting clinical legal education and other reforms in legal education for those countries. I also have done, in conjunction with that, work around legal aid, public defense, and legal services, which is what I did before I began my work in international law. And then, not surprisingly, I think, given our work over the last 3 years on a case involving representation of a detainee in Guantanamo Bay, I have focused a good deal of my scholarship on the right to defense and to fair trial in international criminal law. The clinic, which, as I mentioned, gives rise to a lot of the subject matter of my own writing, and I think I get very interested in some of the cases that we're involved in, and it sort of pulls me towards the theoretical end of things to examine the issue in greater depth. Just to give you a sense of that, before I talk about just a couple of the cases, let me mention that the clinic is now, this year, is 32 JD students, second and third year JD students, with four full-time teachers, which is a good deal bigger than it was when I began with it in 1990, when it was six students and myself. So it has been a very popular offering here at the law school and continues to be. While it is not open to LLMs, we are in the process of designing a piece of work that will make clinical legal education more accessible to LLMs and coming up with some curricular offerings that will make clinical legal education more accessible to the LLM student population. In litigation, just to give you a couple of examples, I've mentioned the Guantanamo case, and students have handled a number of aspects of our representation of Omar Khadr, one of the youngest detainees at Guantanamo Bay. We have done scores of asylum cases in the domestic courts from all over the world, beginning from the Central American region and now expanding primarily into Africa. And then we also do a good deal of work, as Claudio does, with the Inter-American Human Rights Commission and court. We have our two newest cases there involve representation of the family of Jacobo Arbenz, the president of Guatemala, who was deposed in a coup by the CIA and military in his country in 1954, and his family is seeking damages for the loss of their property and reputation during his overthrow. And representation of inmates in the federal supermax in Colorado that you may have read about. There was a piece in the Weekend Post about the maximum security facility in Colorado that doesn't allow inmates access to anything more than 1 hour of sunlight a day and total isolation beyond that. We also, in addition to litigation, do projects that are focused on human rights that include, for example, work here in the District of Columbia on implementation of a local human right to housing in the district. And we're also involved in a Liberian documentation project where the Liberian Truth Commission has asked for statements from Liberians in the exile community, and there's a large community of Liberians here in the D.C. area whose statements need to be taken and then transmitted to Liberia for use by the Truth Commission. So we'll be involved in collecting some of that information. That gives you an idea of the kind of the breadth of work that we do that tries to replicate in our clinic the work that human rights lawyers do in the field after you graduate from this school. Thank you.
Thank you. Does this work?
Yeah.
My name is Patty Dalai. For those of you that may not know, I have been teaching here now for a decade, which was hard for me to imagine that time has gone by so fast. By the time I was 13 years old, I had already lived in three continents and in three different cultures. So for me, being part of any kind of nation state was always not instinctual. I always liked to look back and watch at how people talk to each other. What was their worldview that motivated them? How much lack of understanding there was between people? So being an outsider and observing, I actually saw myself, especially as a teenager, as very much of an observer of humanity. I was particularly affected, I think, by being in this country as a teenager during the hostage crisis and being of Iranian origin because it was a very interesting time, both for, I think, America and for me personally and for Iran. And this, you know, the saga continues. It's not particularly ending. So I have, when I went to law school, I always tell that I probably would have never been gone to law school if I didn't come to America. I think, I don't know if that's true, but I think there is a particular vision of the law and a role of a lawyer here. And the importance of law. And some of us have heard said that we see our Constitution is our sacred scripture. There is a particular vision we have in this country, which I think is somewhat unique given the historical roots of the United States. So I went to law school, realized how culturally constructed the law school experience is. I did enjoy it, but I had to learn things that were look at it from the outside. I ended up practicing international law mainly in terms of in the private business area, representing companies first and then countries, small governments who couldn't afford the legal representation of some of the larger firms. So we developed a boutique practice, which Dania and I share actually because we come from that same firm. But at any rate, from the time I've come here, I said that my interest is in the area of international economic law or international economic relations. Now, almost all law can be called international economic law because it's got some economic aspects to it. But mainly it has been in the area of movement, cross-border transactions in goods, services, intellectual property. If you think about, basically my interest is in trade. I teach international trade and international business matters. But if you think about it, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in China, it was always the trading ports that developed a particular different culture. Trade is a very important instrument. It's been an instrument of colonialism. It could be an instrument of new colonialism, but it's also unifying and causes disintegration and wars. It's a fascinating area. And we live in a very, very interesting time right now where one of the expressions of globalization is this creation through multilateral and regional trade agreements, including particularly the WTO, of a supranational regulatory administrative body. So really my interest in international law, one can say in some ways, is bottom-up than top-down. Instead of looking at international treaties, even though WTO is one, it's really I'm interested in its effect on every aspect of local governance. Basically, there's a vision of the law, particularly promoted by the United States, and our vision of an administrative regulatory state that's being multilateralized through this multilateral institution called the WTO. But there are also others. So I encourage everybody, even those who don't want to do trade, to take the class because it affects employment law, health and safety, labor, any aspect of your relationship with your government, and the importance on procedure, which we have so much in the United States, is what is being now multilateralized through membership in these international organizations and through the international trading regimes. So to look at this this very piecemeal coming up. Forget the trade wars and things like that, but that's all very important, but the effect it has on how laws should be administered. They talk about trade laws, but since the scope of trade laws has expanded so much, everything affects trade. It affects an administration of all laws. And I'm particularly interested, and that's what I like to share with my students as well. Also, in terms of looking at the the world, the perspective, the world view that motivates the actors in this international sphere of developing these international rules for commerce, but now we're seeing more and more affecting other areas such as human rights, workers' rights, environmental regulations. It is a whole new world. It was very, very piecemeal, very, very convoluted. We live in an interesting time, but also nobody is actually examining the underlying values that are moving these processes forwards. There are places in the world we talk about governance, good governance, we talk about publication, we talk about rule of law, we talk about all these things. But I would like to actually, and I think this school has a particular strength in that you look at specific examples in specific countries, activism maybe in this school, that gives you a hands-on experience as to what is actually happening on the ground. What do those things mean? I am particularly, you know, what is the perspective that people have? Especially my recent thing, the role that, for lack of a religion or religious thinking has on these developments in international law. The relationship, which has been unexamined so far, between international law and religion. Which I think is very, very important one to look into. These are all interesting stuff. In terms of Washington is a great place for international trade. I got a smiley face in 1 minute, but I know I've exceeded. Washington is a great place to get experience in international trade, and I'll be happy to help anybody that is interested in that. We have relationships, and we have alumni now in a variety of law firms. The government, United States Trade Representative, Department of Commerce, Court of International Trade, and a lot of experiences with also multilateral agencies here in Washington in the international economic law, which I think Danny will talk about more, in the World Bank and the IMF and IFC. So this is my time is up.
I'm Janie Chuang. I'm the most junior member of the faculty on this panel. in terms of my background in international, or my interest in international law, it goes back quite a ways. I first became interested in international law when I was in seventh grade. I was interested in doing human rights work. I was a member of Amnesty International as a kid and did a lot of organizing in junior high and high school. And went to college intent on studying human rights theory. I was a philosophy major, an international studies major, in search of a philosophical theory for human rights, a knockdown, irrefutable theory for why human rights exist. And towards the end of my college career, I decided to go to law school to study human rights law and eventually become a human rights lawyer. So my passion for human rights goes back a long way. But I have to say, when I was in college, I had this experience having dinner with the executive director of Human Rights Watch, somebody who I idolized for many years, and I said to him, I want to be you one day, and I'm going to law school, and I'm going to be a human rights lawyer. And he said to me, well, the thing to keep in mind is after you graduate from law school, don't come to us. We're not interested in hiring you. what we would prefer is if you were to get some experience in the private sector, learn how to litigate, get a better sense of the government's perspective. If you can do international work in the private sector, that's ideal. And that stayed with me throughout law school, and so I decided after graduation, I started my career actually at the UN, Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. During my time in law school, I ended up doing some research on a new issue, a fairly new issue at the time, of human trafficking, specifically trafficking in women, and wrote an article and ended up getting asked to help advise the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights on a new international law on trafficking that was being drafted. And so I committed to doing that for a year. But before committing to that, I'd committed actually to go to a law firm and work in the area of international arbitration and litigation. So my background in terms of practice is pretty mixed. It's both human rights, but also a private sort of background In my private sector practice, I focused on representing sovereigns, governments, in the context of international arbitrations arising out of the Asian financial crisis, specifically situations where these governments been very deeply affected by financial crisis, were engaged in sovereign debt restructuring, and found themselves, as a result of IMF conditions, unable to perform on contracts, for instance, with investors. And so I ended up representing a number of governments in arbitration over breach of contract, alleged breach of contracts, arising out of these financial crisis, essentially. And I found that to be, I did that for about 5 years. In the private sector, I also worked for the UN Compensation Commission at one point, which is a commission that's set up to, distribute funds. There's a pot of money to distribute funds to individuals and corporations that have been affected by Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. I had a sort of varied experience dealing with international disputes, dealing with both sovereign crisis, but also Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. And so that background, that experience, I found surprisingly satisfying, actually. As a human rights person, I was a little bit skeptical about going into a practice that represented the governments, the same very same governments that I'd written urgent action petitions against as an Amnesty International person, but found it to be a really interesting, compelling practice. And so for any of you who are interested in doing human rights work, I think it's good to get the perspective of the broader sort of perspective and have some exposure to the private side of international law. In terms of my work here, I started out teaching in the Human Rights Clinic with Rick. For any of you who are interested in human rights work or any sort of public interest work, I think it's a great experience to spend some time in the clinic. It's an amazing way to learn how to lawyer and to think about the issues that affect lawyering, like the power relationship between you as an attorney and your client. In terms of my research focuses on issues concerning the intersection of gender, labor, and migration. As I said before, I had done some research on human trafficking when I was in law school, and that's an interest that's continued since law school. I am currently the U.S. member of an International Law Association Committee on Feminism and International Law, sort of this I think there are about 15 of us on this committee representing different countries. And the committee's work involves an 8-year study looking at issues concerning women and migration, specifically the role of international law in managing that migration, both voluntary migration and involuntary migration. And my specific part of that project is to look at issues concerning human trafficking. For me, trafficking is a really fascinating issue and incredibly mostly because I find it incredibly complex, because it's hard to figure out how to characterize a problem. Is it a migration problem? Is it a labor problem? A crime control problem, which actually is the predominant framework, is to treat it as a crime control problem. Is it an immigration problem? Is it a social problem? And so I find that issue really interesting, and to think about, you know, what are the responsibilities of various governments, the countries of origin from which people are leaving, right, the trafficked people are leaving, are they responsible for better management of their migration systems? Are they responsible for ensuring that women who migrate abroad in search of work put in systems that make that migration safer? Or is it the responsibility of destination countries to protect people who have come here as a result of being trafficked and have suffered human rights abuse along the way? And so these are really tough questions that governments are still struggling with. And so I find it an incredibly rich area to research. And so if any of you are interested in it, I'd be happy to talk to you. I also teach international commercial arbitration. I see some of my students here. And I'm happy to talk to you also about that area of practice.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm not the youngest member, but I am wearing the pink shirt, so I can put it at the end of the list. Danny's already given me my 1-minute notice with the smiley face, so I'll be brief. I'm Paul Williams. I teach both here at the Washington College of Law and at American University's School of International Service. I direct the JDMA program and also have recently started up here within the JDMA program something called the Public International Law and Policy Program. I teach advanced issues of international law both here and on main campus. And my primary focus is providing legal assistance, both researching and then actually providing legal assistance on countries involved in peace negotiations and drafting post-conflict constitutions. I spent much of the summer in Baghdad advising the chairman of the Constitutional Review Commission for the Iraqi parliament on amendments to the 2005 constitution. I was in Baghdad with him for the summer of 2005 working on the initial draft of the constitution. We've also provide legal assistance to the government of Sri Lanka in its negotiations with the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers, and about 4 months ago we started working for the Burmese government in exile, advising them on the, sort of the transition process. Just to be clear on that, which side we're on here. So we've been busy these last few weeks doing a lot of work. Our client, who's Aung San Suu Kyi's cousin, the Prime Minister, is in country. And so we've been doing a lot of work, everything from press statements to legal issues to contacting the International Criminal Court, trying to see how they might be interested, doing some work with the United Nations to see how to get them engaged. So a bit of lawyering, a bit of activism, a bit of public relations. Danny asked me to sort of provide a couple of seconds as to sort of how one ends up doing international law, because Danny's one of the few people that knows my dream in life was to be a water lawyer in California. and somehow I ended up here with you guys doing international law. And it all started with the two pieces of advice that I give my current students. One is publish, 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 and publish some more. Be it op-eds, be it reports, be it law review articles, be it books. When I was in law school, I wanted to sound really smart, so I drafted a law review article entitled "Protect Water Marketing and the Protection of In-Stream Values." Basically, the whole idea was, look, it's possible to buy water to leave in the river to protect fish. Kind of a simple idea. Of all of the journalism and scholarship that I've published subsequently, my law review article from my law school years is still my most cited article. Because then I was brave enough and young enough to be over the horizon in my thinking and in my advocacy. And that's what I would encourage you to do when you're thinking about what you're going to write on. Pick a topic that's over the horizon. The best example of this is Michael Scharf. When he was a law student at Duke, he wrote an article on war crimes tribunals. And they're like, hey, that's great, you know, Nuremberg, Tokyo, if you want to putter around about war crimes tribunals, we're not going to bother you. No, how war crimes tribunals can be a mechanism of justice to promote peace. Yeah, sure, go ahead and write that. Michael now is providing legal assistance to every single war crimes tribunal. He's the most prolific author on war crimes tribunal, and he's managed to make a life out of that one law review article that he did in law school, a professional as well as personal life, it seems. So think about what you're going to write and get it right. But think about the over the horizon issues. You have the chance, you have the opportunity to do that now. The other suggestion that Danny and I have talked about quite a bit is networking. Build your network now while you're in law school before you'll need it. And grow with your network. The organization that I operate, the Public International Law and Policy Group, which then has its companion piece within AU, the Public International Law and Policy Program, started out as three friends with laptops. I was at the University of Cambridge doing my PhD on international environmental law. The Bosnian government rang me up and said, look, would you like to fly out to Dayton and be our lawyer during the Dayton peace negotiations? And I said, great. And they said, and anybody else from your organization would like to come? And I looked at my wife and I said, sweetie, you want to go to Dayton? She was it. I didn't have an organization. I was just a former State Department lawyer who was getting a PhD. And I thought on the plane ride out there, maybe I should have an organization when the Bosnians introduced me as their lawyer. So I created in my mind on the United Airlines flight the Public International Law and Policy Group, because it sounds really serious. Terrible acronym, PILPIG, but it sounds serious. It now has over 200 former State Department lawyers, retired Foreign Service officers, half are American and then half are international from other foreign offices. We translate pro bono work from all of the major law firms, Sullivan Cromwell, Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, Wilmer Hale, Baker McKenzie, Sherman Sterling. They all do pro bono work for the NGO, which then goes into about a dozen clients. We're working with the Darfur rebels, as I mentioned, the Burmese, the Armenians. We're working in Ethiopia. We've got some projects in Georgia as well. And basically this network, which doesn't exist, it only has a post office box, but it's basically an NGO which is comprised of all my old friends from the State Department, from academia, and then all my students who graduate and go work for law firms. And that network, which you start building now, will provide you an amazing opportunity as you seek to establish yourselves as international lawyers in the in the community, either providing pro bono assistance, doing scholarship, or simply looking for your next job. One of the things that a lot of my young students who graduated, our young alumni, they use the network to trade jobs. And those at the law firms will trade jobs with those at the UN. Those at the UN will seek to, you know, see who's working at the OECD. And you find that that network that you created in your law school years and early on is very useful and very effective. So my advice is pick some issues that you care about, start advocating on them, start writing on them, start building a network, and if you're really brave, start your own nonprofit with an international law bent, and then use that to propel your career for the next 20 years.
I want to thank everyone on the panel. As I was listening to everyone speaking, it got me nostalgic, thinking about how did I end up an international lawyer. And it made me realize how much things you do when you're young come back to haunt you when you're old. I started off as a student in South Africa, as working in the trade union movement, the very early days of the trade union movement in South Africa. And one of the first projects I worked on was a study of workers in some areas in South Africa that were we were looking to find out how terrible the working conditions were to provide information to the British trade unions to promote sanctions against South Africa. And out of that, I got interested in both foreign investment and in corporate social responsibility, because I realized, I started thinking that the only way to get really good working conditions and good productive activity in South Africa was to have corporations who actually believed in social responsibility. And which was, I think, thinking way beyond where anyone else was thinking at the time, because nobody was talking about that. Everyone was thinking just in terms of we need sanctions, we need to get human rights in South Africa, all of which is very important, but it just seemed to me nothing would be sustainable and less business became more socially responsible. And so when I left South Africa, when I was called up to the army in South Africa, and when I came to this country and I started thinking as a lawyer, or as a law student, what do I do to try to promote this agenda? I thought the most productive place to start thinking about social responsibility was to focus on the World Bank as an institution. Because I thought as a public institution, it's actually more vulnerable to pressure than private corporations, and it has a social agenda, at least on paper. And as a result of that, I got very interested in accountability of international organizations. And I've been working on that for about 15 years. Working on how to develop mechanisms in international organizations that will allow private citizens who believe they've been harmed by those organizations to actually hold the organizations accountable. And I've been involved in a number of different campaigns at the World Bank, the IMF, at various institutions to do that, and we've been very successful. Now my work is focusing mainly on the African Development Bank. I was hired as a consultant about 6 or 7 years ago to advise the African Development Bank on how to develop its own accountability mechanism. And they adopted my proposal eventually, and now I've recently been appointed to that mechanism. And so I get have the opportunity to see how what I designed is being put into practice at the African Development Bank. And we now about to begin our first case in the next month. So that's an exciting proposition to see. But the other thing that struck me when Paul was talking in particular about the importance of networking is one of the other projects I'm working on, which grows really directly out of my work in South Africa as a student, is a project to launch a reconciliation and development bond in South Africa that will fund small-scale development projects through the use of traditional debt financing mechanisms. But what got me thinking about what Paul said is that one of the reasons I've actually managed to get this project almost, or at least to the starting gate, and we'll see whether it actually gets out of the starting gate, is because of connections that I made in that work doing in the early trade union movement, and that when I went back to South Africa to talk to people about this project, I could go back to some of those same people that I hadn't seen in close to 20 years by that point, and build on the connections we had forged during that stage of the struggle to help get this project off the ground. It's not a particularly legal project at this point, but it does have an important international law aspect to it, because it's connected to the whole problem of reparations and justice in transitional societies, which raises both issues of human rights law as well as sustainable development law. So it's an interesting project which hopefully one day I'll be able to come back and invite you all to buy bonds and invest in South Africa. But you're safe. It won't be for a while. So that's how I got into international law. We have a few minutes left, so I think let me open it up for questions to any of us on the panel about how to get into international law or things that you could be doing while you're a student here to develop your career as international lawyers. Someone must have a question. Brian. I'll start, and then I would say the one great myth that most students have is that your first job is going to determine the rest of your career forever. In fact, your first job, you're learning skills and developing networks and opportunities which you can then build on for the future. And so the fact that if your first job is not as an international lawyer, it certainly doesn't mean that you can't won't open doors that will let you get into some aspect of international law later on. You need to sort of make sure that at least some of your pro bono activity has connections to international law so that it's you're developing connections in that area. But
I would just add that if you're life is a series of 5-year plans, and there's always plenty of opportunity to change gears. Just keep your options open. A lot of my students will work for law firms to pay off the debts, get the down payment for the townhouse and other things. But the ABA Sealy project offers wonderful opportunities to get abroad and do pro bono. All the major law firms have strong pro bono commitments. Increasingly, they're doing it in public international law. There's all ways of keeping your term member or the Council of Foreign Relations, getting a JDMA degree, so you have that master's in international affairs when you want to switch out. And don't move in your seventh year, because they'll all assume you didn't make partner, and that's why you're on the market. Move in your fourth or your fifth year, or after you've made partner, then seek to move. But there's ways of keeping your contacts with your network, because a lot of your peers will secure jobs either at law firms and will be looking the same way to move, or they'll secure those handful of jobs at the State Department or U.S. Trade Representative or other places, and they'll know about the job opportunities that do open up for lateral transfers.
The government is a particularly useful place for people if you don't for also international work to get certain kind of skills that you can get in the government that you may not if you think initially you can't get it in private sector.
I would say firms are, keep in mind that firms are pretty, are very diverse, and a number of firms have international practices, and that those that don't, more often than not, are aspiring to have some international component to, for instance, their antitrust practice. More and more antitrust practices are also incorporating European competition law practices, for instance, and so that can get you abroad to work in Brussels. And so just keep an open mind when it comes to law firms and take a very close look at the scope of their practices. And you know, law firms are expanding their offices around the world all the time, and so it may be that there's more international work there than may be immediately discernible.
Any other questions? Well, I want to thank all of you for coming to this event. I hope you'll come to many more of the events this week. There's some boards up that have all the events up, so I'm not going to go through all the events, but thanks for giving us a great launch to the week of International Week. Thank you.